Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, author Ronit Plank talks about losing her mother at the age of 6 years old to the cult leader Bhagwan Shree Rajneesh. And she also talks about joining a coven.
I saw this sign and it said new coven forming, student coven forming. So I'm seeing these ladies every Sunday. I'm seeing my student coven every month. I'm in my room doing tarot. I'm like, the goddess is talking to me. I have the goddess books. I'm like, look, I'm manifesting and I'm creative visualizing what I want. I have power and I'm going to explore what I want to explore.
Today on the show, author Ronit Plank talks about losing her mother to a cult leader and then joining a coven herself. Stay close.
Hey, my name is Ronit Plank and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy. And I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with Simpsons writer Mike Reiss. That guy is just brilliant. He's written on The Simpsons for over 30 years. He took a two-year break at one point. And he's back working in Springfield, and he's just fascinating. He has a brand new podcast we talked about a little bit called Here I Am or This Is Where I Am. That's terrible. I don't know that because I've listened to it a lot. It's really very good. Gosh, I forget though. Anyway, the point is, last week on the show, Mike Reiss talked about his books being banned in like five or six states, like Texas, and all these really super Christian people came at him. Why did they come at him, Ronit Plank? You're never going to believe this.
So the books were either about the benefits of abortion, or they were talking about, they were talking about how people who don't get vaccinated are going to hell.
Well, actually, Mike Reiss wrote a book. It's an animated book, and it is mm-hmm. – it's like the farthest thing from it. He was just, there was a picture of little Richard Nixon, right? Like Richard Nixon as a mm-hmm. kid, or he looked like him. It wasn't really him, but he called him Dick. Mm-hmm. That was his name, like Dick Nixon, because that's what everybody mm-hmm. called him, Dick Nixon. Mm-hmm. And the state of Texas banned the books, as well as many wow. others. But that's not the only funny thing. The other funny thing is Mike talks about his new podcast, which I'm going to figure out the name very quickly here. But anyway, Mike Reiss talks about all these places that he's been that are shitty, right? Like places that you would think are really nice, but are in fact not that great. Like Costa Rica. Are you familiar with Costa Rica, Ronit?
Well, not personally, but my dear sister went there on her honeymoon.
Uh-huh. And did she have a good time?
You know, not so much.
Right, because it's a jungle and there's really nothing to do. It's very, there's no culture or anything. You know, these rainforests. And anyway, Mike Reiss talks about Costa Rica. It cracks me up. And his new podcast is called What Am I Doing Here? And really, besides Storyworthy, you guys should be following Mike Reiss's show, What Am I Doing Here? Because the man is brilliant. Also on the show, he talks about being roommates with Al Jean at Harvard. And, you know, all these writers on The Simpsons, a lot of them, not just some, but a lot of them are Harvard graduates.
I'm not surprised because they're brilliant in their way. Right. You just wouldn't expect them to go into the field.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, comedy, you have to be intelligent to be funny.
And depressed.
Well, sure. But you have to be ahead of the game.
Yes.
To be funny.
Yes.
You can't be lagging behind. You have to be thinking mm-hmm. much further ahead. And so, like, Al Jean, his roommate, was supposed to be a doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Mike Reiss was supposed to be, I don't know, a lawyer or something. And then they combine and they meet Matt Groening and boom, The Simpsons, which is just
amazing.
It is amazing.
It's amazing.
It's very cool.
Right? I can't believe how long that's been on the air. It's unbelievable to me.
It's really a lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, decades.
Definitely.
Anyway, I happen to be doing a Simpsons puzzle right now. I still get my quarantine on a bit, and I am always kind of working on a puzzle, and this is a 1,000-piece Simpsons puzzle.
Oh, you too? I cannot wrap my head around even a 500 word.
Now, who else in your life does a lot of puzzles?
My dear sister, who I referenced before, and I don't call her dear sister when I call her, but I just am trying to indicate to anyone listening that I love her so much, and my dear mother.
Oh.
I can't not say dear mother also. So they both do puzzles. My mom, she lives alone with her dog, and she's like, you'll call her and you're like, hey, mom, how's it going? And she's like, oh, and she gives you a puzzle update. Like, that's all she wants to talk about is her puzzle update. And it's really funny because it's angst for her, right? But when she does it and she completes it, especially the recent 1,000-word one, it is an accomplishment. And, you know, really, I'm glad she does something with her days. It's good for her brain.
Yeah. No, for sure. All that sort of stuff is. But it is funny how, like, I get so much satisfaction as well. Like, what is that? It's so stupid. It's like nobody's making me do it. Why do I get so crazy about, like, okay, I'm not going to bed until I find 10 pieces.
That's hilarious because, well, for me, like, I'm not that way about puzzles. I'm that way about other things. I'll just dig my teeth in and I'm tenacious. But I love not caring about certain things, like puzzles I don't care about. It's such a freeing feeling, being an anxious person and like a control freak like I am, to not care is such a freedom, and it makes me happy that I can hear this story and know that I'll never feel that way about a puzzle.
Yeah, you know what I found I felt that way about was the Pittsburgh Steelers. You know, I'm from Pittsburgh, and when I first got to Los Angeles, you know, it was like going to bars at 10 a.m. to watch football games. Oh. And then we got the Sunday ticket and all that. And about 10 years into my life in LA, I thought, I don't really think I like this sport anymore. And I don't like getting up. And anyway, basically, I haven't watched a game in like 15 years.
Wow, it was like a switch. It just turned off.
It is so refreshing. Yeah, it's like, look at that. I got a lot of, you know, I got a couple hours on Sunday to do something.
Now, I'm curious. I have a follow-up question, but you can tell me if I'm not supposed to ask you questions. My question about this is okay?
Yeah, okay. Follow-up. I'm following excited already.
Following up. I'm curious if you came to some understanding that, hey, I never really liked this. This is something my family liked. Or I thought I liked this, but I don't. Or you were like, I really did like it for a while, and now I'm just different.
Yeah, no, I think as you get older, you know, you realize you have no skin in the game. It doesn't matter how you feel about it. It's not, you don't have, you know, and then you realize there's options. Mm-hmm. And you look, and then, you know, football's become such a business, and nobody has that kind of, you know, allegiance to their teams anymore. You know, the players, they'll switch in a heartbeat. So all that stuff is true. And then also, now that I'm in Los Angeles, there's so much more to do on a Sunday. Whereas back east, if it's cold out, which is, you know, a lot of the time, or at least the skies are gray or raining, then, you know, being home and the fireplace is on and you're watching football is nice.
Yeah, I get it.
And it was a reasonable sport because there were only like 16 games a year, which is reasonable. You know what I mean? Like, I can't get myself invested in 150 baseball games because there's no weight to anything.
That's how I feel like with The Handmaid's Tale. Like when it first like when it first came out, I was like, oh, yeah, I am so watching this. And I really was devoted. And this is a long time ago. This is, I think, when Trump was just in, you know, whatever, an office.
Yes, 16.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, I really love this. And then I found out there was going to be another season. And I was like, more? And I stopped watching it. I couldn't do it. I just knew. I was like, I'm not investing. See,
it was,
and I hear it's still really good. But, and it's not that I'm afraid of pain and trauma and all that stuff because I write about it. But I was just like, I don't know what they're going to do with this. So I feel you with the football. Like there's just too much to catch up on.
Yeah, and it's nice to like have the power, as if we never did, you know. But sometimes you don't think about your options until, you know, until you're in a different situation. And you, of all people, Ronit Plank, will know what I'm talking about. Okay, you guys, usually on the show, you know, my audience knows that I usually have on comedians, writers, people in Hollywood. And I do know you from Los Angeles because you did live out here for like a heartbeat.
I mean, I did do improv, you know. I did take the first couple of classes at the Groundlings.
Well, that's something. I mean, some people have no idea what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, and anyway, now here we are, like 20 years later, and one of my best friends, Jim Coughlin, you know, he emails me that he has somebody for my show here, and you know, Coughlin doesn't give me a lot of references. Not references, what's the word?
Suggestions. Like suggestions, referrals, like, recommendations.
Recommendations. So when he does, I listen. And sure enough.
Jim, thank you. Ronit,
you came up. And boy, oh boy, I'm just so fascinated, as everybody in my audience will be. Now, the title of your show today is Joining a Coven.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to talk about it and learn about your story. But would you just tell me what the word coven is? It's like a bunch of witches.
Yeah. Yes, it's a Wiccan group.
It's a Wiccan group.
Yeah. Okay. You can have all genders, all everythings, and you get together and you do your witchcraft stuff.
Okay, good. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. But the other big thing that you recently did is you wrote a book, and it just came out. And
it's coming out. Coming out.
Oh, it's coming out. My gosh. Yes. Then I got very lucky to get
May 11th, yes.
First copy. Wow. Oh, this
is
so
great. But it's
in
pre-order, yeah, so people can definitely find it.
Great at RonitPlank.com, yes. RonitPlank.com, and I've been reading it. I'm not done yet, but boy, oh boy, it is powerful.
Thank
and
you.
This is your debut.
Yeah.
Are you calling it a memoir or
yes,
a novel?
It's a memoir. It's definitely a memoir.
Yeah.
I'd written like other, you know, I've written short fiction to begin with and realized that a lot of my short fiction had these themes of giving up control and abandonment and emotional trauma. And I was like, hey, I think I've got to work out some things.
Well, you went through so much. And so it's clear that it's all coming out in your writing, which you're so lucky you have an outlet because
yes.
other people might have gone mad, but for sure. Yeah. But now, see, here's the thing. Ronit, you already told me about 2 minutes ago that your mom is living, you know, near you and she's there
yes.
or whatever. Okay, so, but the thing is that's kind of burying the lead. The name of the book is When She Comes Back.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about your mother leaving you at the age of 6 to follow a guru in India
mm-hmm.
as she left you and your little sister. And she just left you with your father, and she just left. So first, your father left you when you were 5, and then she she decides to say, you know what? Okay, you leave me in with these kids. Well, guess what? I'm going to drop them off with you in New York.
Yes.
And he had already been with another woman who had her own teenage kids, and so now you and your little sister, you're like 5 and 6 and 7, and you're living with your dad and this woman and her kids.
Yes.
And your mother just splits. She just leaves. And she tells you it's just for the summer, but it goes on and on. And I don't know if anybody out there has watched it was a Netflix documentary, right?
Yeah, docuseries, yeah.
And tell us about that series. I mean, you must have watched it, obviously.
Oh my gosh, I did, yeah.
Is that what inspired you to write the book?
That's a great question. And it didn't inspire me, but what happened was I had already written the manuscript. It was already in 1 or 2 drafts in 2017-ish. And I was working on it, trying to figure out when to send it to agents, when Wild Wild Country comes out. And that is a 6-part docuseries about Bhagwan and Ma'anand Sheela. And a lot of people saw it because, and I wrote a piece for The Atlantic and for The Rumpus about this because it's a very strange, that's how I broke into The Atlantic. I couldn't believe it because when you have a story like mine and you can link into pop culture like this and what's in kind of the ether, it's just gold, right? So I already had all this material and things I could talk about. But I don't know if you ever saw Waco. Did you see that David Koresh that like dramatization?
Sure, I saw it.
So I remember, this is earlier in 2018. I remember watching it thinking, wow. And it just hit me. I knew nothing about Wild Wild Country yet. I thought, you know, how do the people involved in this feel about this being consumed for mass entertainment? How do the families who were affected feel about watching their loved ones being depicted by actors for entertainment?
Sure.
And then, boom, like 3 months later,
Wild Wild Country comes out. And I didn't know. I don't read The Hollywood Reporter anymore. I don't engage. So I was not expecting this. And let me say, it's like I grew up with this Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh guru in my mouth. The words, right? Well, that sounded weird. His name... That sounds really weird. His name was in my mouth. Like, from a young age, I knew how to say it. I knew my mom's Indian name. I knew, like, all of this cult stuff, Rajneesh Puram and Rancho Rajneesh. But not a lot of people did know it. And we didn't have the internet. And we didn't, like, it just was something I forgot about. I didn't want to see that guy's face. I did not want to look at a book with his picture on it. I did not want to hear anything about it. And then all of a sudden, I'm starting to write this book about it. And I'm sort of dredging up all this history. And I've got this book, and then boom, Wild Wild Country comes out. And I think, holy moly. And like any good, you know, struggling artist, I'm thinking, I better get on this. I better wrap up my work with what's going on here and get it out as soon as I can. So sure. I incorporated some Wild Wild Country and the impetus of like how it made me go deeper into the story, because I watched that kind of with my arms tight across my chest, scared that I might see my mom in the footage. And also wanting to see my mom in the footage, but also not wanting to see my mom in the footage. And I watched all six episodes sort of looking for her, which is a really strange sensation. And also getting a glimpse for the first time of what this world was that Bhagwan created. And I can only express it like, it's like hearing the legend of Atlantis. It's like knowing that there's this like myth of Atlantis, and then all of a sudden, like, it rises from the sea and you're like, oh my gosh, it's really there. Like, I can see it and touch it. And that's what this old story coming into like the public domain felt like for me.
Wow. It's so interesting to see. You already told me your mom. So I am only partway through the book.
Yeah.
And I'm loving every second of it.
Thank you.
And I don't know what's going to happen. Now, I'm assuming your mother now came back because you... She lives with
nearby,
you.
Nearby. Like five minutes, yeah.
So she, okay, so I don't know if I want to, I don't know if I want you to tell me the end of the book. Mm. But because, it, and also that's kind of her story that she left, but it's your story that yeah. she left you. I mean, I just, and you have two children now, you told me,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do, yes. And I love what you just said, Christine, because I love what you said. That's such a memoirist take, and I feel so strongly about memoir and writing people's stories and stuff. Like, and that's part of the podcast is like listening to people's story, my podcast. But I feel like my mom had her reason for leaving. She had her life and what happened in her childhood that created this circumstance for her not to be able to stay present, right? And that's part of the book. But that affected me and it affected my sister. And each of us siblings have a different, you know, response to it. We processed it differently. And my father processed it in his way. And so that's why stories are so interesting and important, as you know, because we all have our own take on them. And until you really dig in and see what makes someone tick, you don't know. Like, you know, and I reacted differently than somebody else might have. My takeaway, among others, was, huh, well, I guess I'm not worth that much. Like, I must not be that great of a kid. And this was all subconscious. If someone could leave me, like, what am I then?
Of course. I get it.
Right.
And it's, yeah. I mean, terrifyingly, it's true in a way. I mean, at that moment, yes. their headspace was, it is more yes. important. And my father left me, but it was, I was older, right? I was 15, so it's a different thing. Mm. But I'm just saying.
So hard.
It's, oh my gosh, it messed up my whole life. My whole life.
Yep. I mean, that's exactly the thing. And like, I feel so strongly that when you start to really search and excavate into people's histories and backstories, you see the reasons for some of their behavior. And that's not to, you know, vindicate people or let them off the hook for doing things that are not okay and hurtful to other people. But there's usually a story there. And a part of my work on the book was to kind of really try to get into the head and figure out what happened here, right? Not to point fingers, not to throw anyone under the bus, but to be like, who were these people and how did this happen? And that kept it kind of moving for me and interesting because I was sort of figuring out my parents.
So has your mom seen that movie or that docuseries?
You know, that's really funny. Did she? I think she probably started it and I don't know if she ever finished it. Like, we have a very interesting back and forth about Bhagwan because she's really open and talking with me about it now. But you know how there's always like a line of like a place where you will never agree, you know, and you'll bump up against that with people that you care about. And you just have to know when to just kind of back on down.
Yeah. In other words, you and your sister I mean, this forgiveness that you've obviously given is just, you know, it's immense.
Well, I think I can speak for my sister, although she too has two children and we're both really devoted moms. I mean, that doesn't mean we don't make mistakes, but our kids have always been and always were going to be so important to us. I think we always wanted children.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we got that from our father's nurturing or if it was innate. You know, I mean, I always loved animals growing up and still I always wanted to take care of people. So maybe it is nature. I don't know. But like my mom didn't get any of that growing up.
Right.
She got none of it. And then look what happened.
Right. Exactly.
So who knows? And, you know, who knows what happened with your father, right?
Right. Oh, no, I get it. But when you were only 5 and 6 years old, you were acting matronly to these little kids that you were put in. I didn't know about, and I'm sure there's different kinds of kibbutzes in Israel, and I'm sure there's many different, you know, rules and regulations, but the one you were in,
Kibbutz Lahav,
then what happened is, I'll let my audience know, in this particular kibbutz, you didn't get raised by your parents. They put all the children in a center together where they did everything together, including sleep together, eat their meals together, everything. And the parents would see you like every day, but only for like 2 hours.
Yeah, concentrated time. And by the way, you are such a close reader. That's amazing that you're able to tell me back the things in my book. It's like a gift to hear that. Thank you. Aww. So yeah, it was called like a children's house. And you had a group for your age. And depending on how many babies were born in your age group, that's who you traveled with. And you slept in the same room. From 6 weeks, you were taken from your mom. And this sounds very violent, but it wasn't. The idea was, my dad clarified it for me. The idea was, oh, look at you. You're upset.
You can't believe it.
Yeah, Christina's clutching her face a little bit, like incredulous. So essentially the idea was, and this was the old version of kibbutzim, and that's a plural of kibbutz, is it was supposed to help free up both women and men to do the labor of the kibbutz, whatever that was, farming, factory work, whatever. So the kids were all fed collectively and taken care of collectively by women called metapelim or metapelot, which is like a counselor, and they would take care of the kids while the parents did their thing. Then for 2 to 3 hours every afternoon without fail, everyone took a break and they would sit down and have snacks and tea and you would visit with your parents and it was concentrated. And the idea behind it was that these dads had more time with their kids than those in the city because it was this guaranteed time every afternoon, right? Because if you think about it, you could justify it and say, hey, we're so busy on the day to day that we don't actually spend quality time with our children throughout the day. Like we're running around. This was concentrated. But still, as a child, if you no longer live in the home where you have parents from 6 weeks on, it's got to create some attachment issues.
So nobody was nursed.
Well, they could be nursed, but my mom couldn't produce milk for me or didn't know how to wait long, whatever the story. So I went to a bottle. But if you were nursed, I'm sure your mom would come to your children's house and feed you and then go back to do what she did. And it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't punitive. I don't want people to get the impression that it was like, aha, we are taking your children away. Like you were like, go child, go play with the kids your age and be raised communally in
6 weeks. 6 weeks. A baby doesn't even know they're out of the mother's stomach.
I know. I mean, I can only imagine. And I do think, and I haven't dug into this enough yet, and I do need to research this because there have been little reports I read about, you know, kibbutz kids are a little woo. We talked to this one guy. We went back in 2018, and we went to Israel, me and my family of four. And we had a guide at one point who said in his translation, I forgot what he said, but he's like, don't get me wrong, but kibbutzniks, you know, they need a lot of therapy.
Yeah. Well, obviously. It just blows me away. And even in the book, you say that you didn't have your own clothes. You just went to like the drawer of everybody's clothes.
Yeah, you're like small, medium, or large. But unfortunately, I was like the tallest and the biggest, so my clothes just like never fit. And I think that's where some of my early associations with being too big and being chubby and being wrong came from.
You don't look big or chubby at all. I mean, what was that?
But you know what I mean? Well, my uncle – well, that's a whole other aspect of the book. My uncle called me Miss Piggy when I was, you know, in elementary school. And, you know – I had like a, you know, it's kind of doesn't matter, right? How we look, right? It's how we feel. But I definitely heard from my father growing up. And look, I was not a small child. I wasn't like ginormous, but I wasn't small. And I was always the tallest. I always had a little pot belly. But I remember my father saying things like, well, your sister can have another, you know, cookie, but you can't, you and me, we can't eat those. So those kinds of things, as any woman and maybe some men know, is going to really start working at you.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the book so far is so fabulous. You guys go over to RoniePlank.com and get her book when she comes back. It's just stunning. It really is.
Thank you so much. And I should tell your listeners before we move on that anyone who pre-orders the paperback actually right now, if you message me or send me an email and let me know what you bought, I will send you the audiobook that I narrated as a gift.
Wow.
We're giving it to anyone who pre-orders.
How did your audio recording go?
I went to a studio in West Seattle because I wanted someone to direct and produce me, and it was great. I mean, it was really fun.
Oh, good. And it didn't only take a day or a couple of days?
It did not take that long. It actually took 3 days, like 3 to 4 hours a piece, I think.
That's great.
And a little bit of redos. And it was fun for me because I used to act and I was just sort of like diving in, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's how I know you, because my buddy Jim Coughlin, you were in a movie with him called The Human Being.
Which is so funny. And now that you mention it, I really should probably put that on my website because it's too funny.
It's like awesome.
It's a funny one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really
and
funny.
And he's so good in it too.
Yeah, he sure is. Yeah. Jim is great. He has a new website, jimcoughlin.com. I know it intimately because I built it. So there you go.
Oh, well, then you and I need to talk.
Really? Your website looks all right. What's going? Why? You don't like your website?
No, I mean, you can always improve things. Oh, am I right?
What are you using, by the way? Do you know? Squarespace? Or?
Yeah, no, WordPress.
Oh, WordPress. I see. I don't use that one, so I'm not sure. So we're going to go over to your story when I joined a coven in just a second. But I did want to remind everybody we're playing Story Smash, the storytelling game show, almost every Friday night on Facebook and YouTube at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And I say that because we're taking off a week in April and a week in May. But check storiesmashshow.com and you'll see the schedule. Or you can, of course, go to storyworthypodcast.com. You know, and you're probably my friend on Facebook anyway. If you're not my friend on Facebook, what are you doing? Where have you been? Please. Don't join my personal page. Go to Storyworthy. That page, that's like the, you know, the show page. Would you do that? Would anybody do that? Will you? Will you also follow me on Twitter? Is that possible? I don't beg often. That's the thing. Somebody told me recently, you know what you need to do, Christine? You need to beg more. I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if they want that. A lot of people have known me a long time. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have known me a long time. I don't know if that's what they're looking for. But anyway, I do have a great mailing list. And again, storyworthypodcast.com. Join my mailing list. I do put some time into that. And I enjoy a good mailing list. So if you have a good one, I'll join yours and you join mine. All right, you guys, she's here right now. You heard her talking, Ronit Plank. Like we said, she's an author, and she has her own podcast, And Then Everything Changed. And I love the title. I teach podcasting on the side because I have, like, you know, 45 jobs. But Ronit, I do love this title, And Then Everything Changed, because it is about pivotal moments that happen in people's lives. And you talk to authors and people that are in recovery.
Yeah. Survivors, people who have been through things, even, you know.
But not comedians?
No, I'll talk. Well, it's weird. My husband, okay, no, yes, comedians, but you have to have a story that's meaty. And I'm not saying that you don't. I'll talk to anyone. The thing is, my people come to, like, listen and feel and figure something out, but we're not like a selling platform. We're not like an entrepreneur space. It's like kind of like, let's go deep and figure out what your story is and let's see how you changed and got over it, or like got resilience in you. What's your story, right? And it's funny, my husband will always say to me, why do you always do things so serious? He doesn't say it exactly like that, but he'd be like, go for the funny, because I used to have another podcast called Mouthy, Messy, Mandatory, where we would just banter and do pop culture stuff. And then I switched to this, and he's like, I can't really listen to all the episodes. He'll, like, listen to the former athletes. He'll listen to the, like, immigration lawyers I have on. But if it's too painful, child loss or cancer, you know, alcoholism, he just really can't. It's too much for him.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. Fair enough. Fair enough. But comedians often have a juicy story. I mean, that's why they have the you know, any kind of interest in going on stage for rejection and to begin
with. No, I mean, I'd like love to have you on.
You should. I have a couple of meaty stories. Yeah. If you don't believe me, my audience, you guys can head over to Twitter at Ronit Plank, R-O-N-I-T-P-L-A-N-K, and you tell her that I have a couple of good stories because my audience knows there's a lot going on. But anyway, I'm so excited to hear. I never joined a coven, that's for sure. So I'm excited to hear your story. All right, you guys, do head over to RonitPlank.com and follow her everywhere on social media at Ronit Plank. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Ronit Plank.
Okay, so as you know, I was exposed to a lot of things growing up that not a lot of kids are always exposed to. My mom followed Est, which is like this kind of spiritual thing with Werner Erhard. I guess you're not part of that book. You didn't get to that part of the book yet. But it was kind of a precursor to the forum. So she did that and she followed this guru. Christine is grabbing her face again. Whenever I say something like particularly like interesting or like, I don't know, cringeworthy, your host of Storyworthy is grabbing her face and disappearing behind her beautifully manicured fingers.
No, here's the thing. This is why I'm laughing, because anybody who approaches me like in any sort of a way of like, let's go away from the weekend and we're going to break it down, we'll make you cry, but then you'll be stronger. You're just going to make a phone call, apologize to somebody, be stronger, give it up, do this or that. That's so cringing to me, because if you think I would go away to a place like that, it's just like, it's beyond the realm of my thinking. I mean, I would more likely, I'm not going to do this, but I'm just saying, like, I would do crack cocaine before I would go that way. I would.
Well, no, the same thing. Like, I mean, had my mom not joined a cult, who knows? Maybe I would have been like, cults are awesome. But I'm like really averse to coercive religion. I'm really averse to and wary about people who seem just a little too charismatic or use the same words over and over. If it's like jargon, like, I can't take it. I have to work on a piece about that because it really just gets under my skin. But that's why it's even.
No, that just cracks me up. That makes me laugh because I would like to say it better. I would like to say, you know, what I don't enjoy in life are coercive religions. You make it sound so nice. And all I can do is hide my face.
Like, really? Like, your posture got worse and your face disappeared between, like, crumpled into your hands like a cushion. I was like, what happened to Christine? I just made her go away.
But I might start doing this show with video. Like, that's one of the thoughts I have for 2021. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons, because I guess it's funny.
It is funny because then I can see the impact. It's like you're doing it again. Like, she's doing it again. Okay. So I don't think we're going to have time for this story. It's not even.
No,
okay,
I want to hear it.
Okay, all right. So anyway, the point is, like, I grew up, like, my mom for my graduation from high school gave me like a psychic reading, a professional astrological reading. Like, this is where I'm growing up, right? I'm like, ooh, what's your sign? And animals talk to me and like people follow Indian masters. Like, this happens. And so I go to college and I'm seeking, you know, you're in college, right? You're like 20 and you're just lost. And maybe you're not popular. Maybe you realized you didn't want to rush for a sorority. Like, you knew it was not your style. You don't do sports. You're like a theater person. I'm obviously talking about myself. And, you know, you're looking around. You're like, what am I going to do with my life? What's happening? And then I knew that I wanted to get involved in some kind of different spirituality. I'm Jewish, but of course, a lot of Jews, we kind of wander literally out of our religion. And so I saw this sign and it said, new coven forming, student coven forming, sign up here or like take a tab. You're laughing again because like she's holding her face again, but it's like a half hold. It's not the full. So
so funny. You see a sign that says new coven forming and you think like, oh, well, no, hang on.
Yeah.
And that makes you stop.
You know what I thought? I'm going to tell you. What's that they say? This is a close up in my movie about my life. Music close up. What's that they say about when the student is ready, the teacher appears? And then I was like, bloop, 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 bloop. And so I took the tab and I called. Back in the old days, you take the tab off, you call, there's no phones. And I go to this meeting in upstate New York. I went to SUNY Binghamton, by the way. This meeting I go to after calling and talking to a woman on the phone. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know this house. I don't know these people. And I show up. There's a man and a woman and a bunch of people from the town, otherwise known as, is it okay to say townies? Is that okay to say?
Yeah, I think townies. So.
And like everyone's different ages. And I'm like there, I'm like, oh, like I'm the only college student. I'm the only Jewish girl from Long Island here. Like I kind of know I don't belong here, but I stay. So we do these covens, this group. They're like a studying to be a high priest and a high priestess, this couple. And in part of what they need to do is have these student covens to like help them practice how to be a priest and a priestess. So I start going to that like every month. We do these like moon rituals and it's cool. There's like snacks at the end, which I find more interesting really than the procedure.
So what do? You go to somebody's house?
Yes, we go to the house. We cast a circle. We like draw the circle. We have the different elements represented. We have like, you know, we the little directions, north, south, east, west. Like, you know, it's been a long time, but we have the crystals. We're
do
like,
you wear a robe?
No, I don't wear a robe, but they wore a robe. I'm just like
a funny hat.
No funny hat, but I have by this time bought pentacle earrings. I have by this time started to explore pentacle necklaces. I'm like in my room a lot more with my tarot cards. My two Jewish roommates are kind of like, what the heck? And then I do a spinoff coven with three other ladies who are from the town. You're laughing at the spinoff coven.
A spinoff coven.
And then,
oh, wow.
So I'm seeing these ladies every Sunday. I'm seeing my student coven every month. I'm in my room doing tarot. I'm like, the goddess is talking to me. I have the goddess books. I'm like, look, I'm manifesting and I'm creative visualizing what I want. I know more than I did last month, the month before. I am a Jewish girl from Long Island, but I have power and I'm going to explore what I want to explore. And of course, there is a community celebration coming up for Candlemas. Candlemas sounds like Christmas, but it's not. And I almost didn't go because I'm Jewish and it said Candlemas. And I was like, I don't know about this. It's going to be at the big, big Unitarian church. And this is Binghamton, okay? So if anyone's been to upstate New York, it's like kind of one of those depressed towns. It's cold, cold February.
But they have those good sandwiches called...
I know what you're going to say. What is it?
They're like a slider, but they're called. I'll think of it.
I was a vegetarian, and a vegan, I'd never ate those.
I'll think of it.
Okay, so you know, I'm excited because I feel like I found my calling, and I want to do this. And so I go to this Candlemas celebration. My other witch friends aren't going, and my little roommates are like. Bye. It's like February, ice cold, ice dark. And I think, okay, it's going to be fine. The goddess is going to protect me. I'm fine. Walking on the dark streets. And I go in and it's a giant Unitarian church, giant, you know, sweeping arching ceilings, you know, whatever, beige rug, lots of witches milling around, lots of, you know, crushed velvet, lots of feathered hair because it's upstate New York. There's like lots of heavy jewelry and there's a smell of patchouli like every time someone walks by. And I have to say, like, I really don't see anyone who is my age. I don't really see anyone who looks like me. I don't see anyone from any of my covens. And I'm like, I don't know. You know, this is weird. Like, I'm Jewish. This is weird. I don't know if I belong here. And so then some drums start beating. You know, some animal skin drums. I don't know where they're coming from, but I hear the drums and people are starting to like move a little bit and the lights go dimmer. And I'm like, oh gosh, I hate public dancing, by the way. Like I really hate it. Like I don't like dancing in public. And so we're getting into a circle. We're circling up all the witches. I'm a witch in training, circling up and people start to like do a little whoop calling and stuff like that. And then in the middle of the circle, all of a sudden, this guy with like a bare chest and tights, black tights, young guy, pops out into the middle of the circle. And he's like got feathered hair, like a mullet, and he starts to dance and the ladies start to catcall. And I'm like, what's going on? Like, who is this guy? Is he like a stripper? What's happening? And everyone seems to know what's happening here. And he's sort of dancing in the middle and everyone is whooping and catcalling, throwing things like occasional roses. People are getting very excited. And I feel very much like I'm in an organized religion. I feel very much like I'm now part of a groupthink that I don't really feel comfortable with because, you know, of my past. I'm like, this doesn't feel quite right. Like we're all looking at the same thing. We're all like directed toward this one thing. And then all of a sudden, he goes to the edge of the circle. And when he returns, he is wearing a rack of antlers. And now the crowd is going wild. He is a stag king,
because that is what Candlemas is about. It's like about the return of the Stag King, the sun god. And he's like, you know, dancing with his hoof feet and he's like moving his antlers. He's like, what is that, rutting? And the women are going crazy. And I'm like, this is weird. And also, I have to admit that he was kind of cute. And I felt weird about that too, because I was like, this guy is not my people. I don't understand what's happening. And I'm looking around and I'm all alone. I'm like, you know what? This is not me. This is not for me. I cannot do this. Like, this is not what I wanted. I wanted some self-actualizing spirituality. I did not want this like group collective thing, this blob, you know? And I didn't want this like idol worshiping, if you think about it, because I don't know if you know, but like Jews were not supposed to worship idols. And I backed out of that room, back out, left, walked out of there into the cold night. And I was like, done with the coven life. I was just like, this is not for me. This is done. I'm not done. You know, I'm not doing this anymore.
And how old were you?
20.
20. Yeah. And did your mom, did you ever tell her about it?
Yeah. I think, you know, I was like, I'm trying, you know, Wicca, I'm trying witchcraft. I mean, she gave me my tarot cards.
Right. You know? So, I mean, I guess at some point you have to fast forward when your mom came back into your life. I guess we need to know. I mean, my audience needs to know that. Yeah. When did she come back
okay,
into your life?
Okay, so we were never officially, like, never talking or estranged, but we never had the talk about what had happened, and I was never authentically myself with her. We would go out in the summers to see her, my sister and I, sometimes in Seattle, because, well, that, I don't want to give anything away, but right. And, you know,
she came back from India.
Yeah. Well,
and the ashram was in Oregon, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I know you're probably not at this part of the book, but this is not.
But I saw that series.
Yeah.
But I did.
This
see
is
the
not
series.
Giving anything away. She went away to India. Then she left again toward the end of the Wild Wild Country location, the ashram in Antelope, Oregon. It was called Rancho Rajneesh. And she went there just before the FBI came in to try to find Bhagwan and shut everything down.
So, there were like 6,000 people there, I believe.
That's right. And you know, do you remember they bust in a whole bunch of people who were living without homes to try to occupy more land?
Wow.
And they also, for anyone who doesn't know, but this is in the book, the Rajneesh Puram was responsible for the largest bioterror attack on U.S. soil.
Wow. And what was that in terms of
salmonella?
His followers?
Yeah, yeah, his followers. They poisoned salad bars with salmonella to try to sicken people so they wouldn't vote for the town people.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
How did they do that?
Well, they had a lab. It was like a bioweapons lab on the property, you know, and so they were kind of trying to isolate the AIDS, you know, the AIDS virus, and they were also trying to develop bioterror weapons to try to retaliate these, you know, against these townspeople who were pushing back against their being there in Antelope. And that's what Wild Wild Country has a lot of, you know, a lot of that.
And the FBI finally busted them on those charges, right?
Yeah. Well, there was also immigration issues, and I think there was money laundering. I mean, that's how they got them. But there were a lot of other things going on, and there are a lot of books that I, you know, that you can read and that I reference, you know, that people can always reach out to me if they want to learn some titles of books to get some backstory. But yeah.
I kind of think the idea of following a cult would be, it's kind of refreshing in a way, you know?
Go on, I'm listening.
just leave everything and just say screw it, and you don't have to think anymore because somebody will tell you what to do, when to wake up, when to pray, when to sit, when to go to the bathroom, what to eat, when to eat.
Yep.
And you could kind of erase your past in a way.
Well, also think about it. Like, a lot of people will say, well, what's a cult and what is a religion? What's an organized religion? What's a cult? And some people will say the definition itself is interesting and suspect, and we should really examine, like, how is, you know, Catholicism different, or how is they make this point a lot. And I think that a friend of mine who's had a really hard time with a couple of her children, one has had, you know, severe birth, you know, things that happen at birth to him. You know, she said anytime she hears my story, she's like, I would have liked to have gone to a kibbutz. I could see wanting to run away. You know, she would never do it, but she can understand
that support,
you know, that you would want. I mean, look, when you had your daughter, like when I had my first child, I was,
I mean, the bottom fell out. I was a good mom, but I felt so isolated when my husband went to work. I felt like, what am I going to do all day with this baby? I felt desolate. And I don't know that I had postpartum depression necessarily. I was never diagnosed or anything. But you know what it feels like when you have a baby and you're alone. So to have a kibbutz around you to help you, I mean, it does sound kind of appealing. Why are you laughing?
But because not that I'm going to give up my kid at 6 weeks. That's like, no, right? That's what you do. It's a kitten. And even then, it's eight weeks.
No, I know. And my dad, it's interesting. You might appreciate this. They didn't have the kids eating in the dining room with the parents. It was like very separate. Like the kids had to eat with their own people. Right. My dad couldn't believe this. He wanted to eat with me at one point. So he brought me into the dining room. He's like, I'm breaking the rules. And people were pretty pissed off because there were not supposed to be kids in the dining room with the adults.
Wow. Yeah. You know? That's just crazy. That's just so wild. And so why do you think, and then we got to wrap this up, why do you think there were cults were so big in the 70s and 80s?
I know, right?
I think, well, let me just, of course, I'm going to be my opinion. No, but
let's hear your opinion,
one
Christine.
One of the reasons I think is that the therapy wasn't as generous as it is now or widespread. You know, it just wasn't as accessible.
Sure.
In the 70s and 80s, everybody was, it was a different time. There was even more racism. There was even more less tolerance for everybody. Remember?
Yeah, much more prejudice.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, gay marriage was not even thought of, let alone legalizing weed.
Even people with disabilities. We were just watching this movie, Crip Camp. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever heard
that,
of it.
Yeah, I know that.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, people didn't even have rights. Like, there was nothing.
It's just crazy.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's part of why people would join a cult, because they couldn't talk to their parents and they couldn't admit like that they, whatever they needed to admit, and they couldn't do it because their parents, it just wasn't like that.
I also think it was like piggybacking on that. There's also the time, the era, right? You had like, you know, the hippie situation in Vietnam and all that stuff before. And then you've got this like, well, what are we going to do, right? Like it's kind of just after that era where people are still searching. But the whole Woodstock generation, it's a little bit later now. And people are looking for direction. And maybe that had opened a little crack into this idea that there's more than just these bossy governments and these bossy religions. And I don't want to conform. And, you know,
right.
Coming
there's
out of the 50s.
People that are like-minded.
But the thing is, like, in my opinion, and I'm writing a piece on this right now, you know, anytime you've got someone in charge, it's very in charge in this way, a charismatic leader, it's almost impossible for them not to get drunk with power and exploit the people who follow them. Like, you got to watch out. Like, usually something weird is happening. And I just wonder about bullshit detectors. Like, I have a very strong bullshit detector, but I don't know if I always would have had that or if it's a result of my growing up. But I just feel like if I got into that situation, I'd be like, you know, I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to strip naked and dive into that vat of whatever. Like, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah. Do you think the coven was the last time you did?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm really the closest I ever got to like following like a whole set of guidelines and think that way was when I was telemarketing in New York when I was an actress, and I had to like use strong cold calling techniques to, you know, and I followed by the book and I was a really good seller. But that too was its own like dogma.
Yeah.
You know?
Ugh, that's a nightmare. That's a horrible kind of job for sure.
It is definitely
hard.
And
where do you live now?
I'm in Seattle, which is very ironic because that is where my family broke apart.
That's right. In the book, you were in Seattle, and I kept thinking about, you know, the rain and the dampness and how everything's always kind of damp and everything is wet.
And the people are too. Let me tell you, coming from a like buoyant kibbutz where people were vibrant and like bossy and told you how they felt, to come to this sort of wan, very, very subdued place was kind of a culture shock.
Yeah, I'm surprised you chose it. I mean, there's beautiful parts. I mean, Seattle, there's so many beautiful parts. I've been to people who, you know, look out onto what are they looking at?
Lake Washington,
and they see the Sound, Puget Sound, and the boats
go
by, and it's so lovely. And I could see that, but that's also prohibitively expensive.
Well, it's also weird. Like, I grew up in New York. I lived in L.A. for, you know, 5.5 years. I've lived in these cities that people want to go to, and Seattle happens to be one of them, or it was. But
I think moving to Seattle was a product, when we did it 15 years ago, of the old version of myself that wanted to believe in certain things that were not true about my family before I understood my story the way I do now. And if it happened, if I had the opportunity now, I don't think I would have made the same choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. I do love it there. I love the nature aspect of everything, but the weather kicks my ass, man. I mean, it must
No, it's not good for people.
So
my husband is like, when are we leaving?
Expensive to play tennis there, right? Because there's no outdoor courts.
Oh. Wait, do you play tennis?
I do. Do you?
My husband's mad for tennis. He has a nonprofit that helps kids who are under-resourced get to play tennis.
Oh, that is such a great idea. Because it's a sport where you just need a racket and a ball. You don't need anything.
Mm-hmm. And it's an access thing, too. And so they do, like, tutoring for kids who don't have somewhere to go after school or
Oh, that's so nice.
And tennis, yeah.
Yeah, tennis is also great. Well, it's great for many reasons, but you can play it your whole life. And, you know, well, you know all the good stuff.
Well, yeah, it's funny to be a tennis wife because I'm like, go have fun, honey. I don't know how to do that.
Well, it's so much better than a golf wife because a tennis wife is the guy or the girl's only gone 2 hours, 2.5
it's
hours.
True.
Golf,
it's true.
You're in for like the weekend. They can't go out Friday night because they got to play early on Saturday. And, you know, it's like, I mean, it's like it's a chunk of time that is now gone. I don't know.
Yes.
Anyway, I love golf, by the way. That being said, I do love golf.
You're a lot more active than I am. I'm just shaking my head like, wow, wow. I'm nodding like, wow, wow. Like as if I could think of something that I do that you do. But I don't do any of those things.
Well, I mean, again, you're in Seattle. I mean, that's it's a whole different thing. Yeah. So you must have a lot more books in you because you have a hell of a life.
I do have some books in me. Yeah, I have actually a short story collection coming out. I won a prize. It's coming out next year. I already have another book for 2022. And then I have two nonfiction book proposals I'm working on and a young adult novel that's in the works.
That is so exciting. All right, you guys. Well, listen, we got to wrap it up. But Ronit, you are so interesting and just fabulous. Hey, you know, maybe you could come on my game show, Story Smash, because the stories you would tell would just like explode people's minds.
Let's do it.
Okay. I'm going to book you on that right away.
And also, you're such a good host, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate it.
You are so awesome.
And thank you for sending me the book. Really, it's a treat. I can't stop reading it. You're a very good writer. You guys,
thank you so much.
Find Ronit over there at her website, ronitplank.com. And of course, follow Storyworthy wherever you hear your podcast. Come on, man. You know what to do. Don't make me beg. All right, you guys. One more time on behalf of the very talented Ronit Plank. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Story Worthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.